Good evening. Welcome to City of Angels Families in Recovery. My name is Bill, and I'm here with my lovely wife, Kathy.
Hello.
And we're here with two friends, Shanna and Pete.
Hello.
Hi.
And our topic tonight is getting off the merry-go-round. But before we start with our topic, I would just like to say that if you would like to reach out to Kathy and I, you can email us at Kathy with a C and Bill at cityofangelsnj.org. If you're in need right now to talk to somebody, you're having a hard time, you want to talk to somebody, you could call City of Angels at 609-910-4942. I'm looking forward to tonight. It's going to be an exciting program that we have here with Shanna and Pete. And Kathy and I, we're going to be talking about getting off the merry-go-round of addiction and different aspects. We're going to be looking at Shanna and Pete's story. We're going to be looking at dual addictions, both of them addicts in sobriety at this time. We're going to talk about the mental aspects and how it associates with addiction, the impacts of it, and how what goes on with. We're going to be looking at some of the triggers that we experience in life that cause us to go back into addictions. And of course, and then on top of that, Kathy and I will be talking about how the family could help the addict. Pete and Shannon will be sharing their thoughts on how maybe the family could have helped in different ways and better ways to enhance their recovery. And of course, we're going to be talking about some techniques that also could help in recovery.
Absolutely.
Right? Sounds good?
Sounds great.
Cool. So which one of you two want to go first and just talk a little? Okay, Shanna. No, let her start first.
Ladies first.
Ladies first.
All right. Go ahead, Shanna.
Hi, I'm Shanna. So I guess I'll start by talking about, you know, how I started. I started drinking when I was 13, and I think I always had a fascination with it for some reason, like being more mature, and it seemed glamorous to me almost, and it felt adult. And then when I did it, I really liked the feeling of being out of myself. I had a lot of anxiety as a kid, and I was very shy. When I drank, all that went away. It was like this wonderful relief.
And did you start alone by yourself or with friends partying?
With friends.
Okay.
With friends. And it made me more social with friends. Like I was more open and outgoing and I wasn't as nervous.
Yeah.
The adults in your life, were they modeling that for you?
No.
There's not addiction in your family history?
Well, there is. Okay. There is.
But that's not...
your immediate parents might not have been...
But they weren't. My parents weren't. And my grandfather was.
Okay.
My dad's dad.
You picked it up just to try it?
But I took it to the other level. And as a teenager, I thought, well, I'm just being a teenager. It is like a lot of kids do that. This is what kids do. I didn't think about my future.
Right.
That was a problem, too. It didn't really affect my school, though.
Wow.
I did well in school.
And basically, then you were staying with the drinking part?
Just the drinking and
high school. So how long did that go before it started to...
I didn't start smoking pot till maybe my junior year of high school.
Okay.
But I only did it like a handful of times.
So that'd be 4 years later. So you went about 3-4 years just drinking. Now it started to turn. So what happened got you into the next level?
I went away to college. I went up to UMass for a semester. And I was overwhelmed. It was too big of a change for me, I think. Like, I was just really... I was drinking a lot, partying a lot. And I wasn't doing well. I came back home, took off from school, didn't go back for a while. And when I came back home, I started hanging out with different people. And that's when I tried... What did I try first? I think it was cocaine.
Wow, you went right to cocaine.
Well, no, because in high school, she went from drinking
to pot.
Pot, and that's your gateway drug.
You're right.
So you're doing a lot. And now you came home and went to the next level.
Right.
And by that time, you didn't complete your education, so you were there for like a semester or something.
A semester, and then I just took off.
So again, she's only now 19, 20.
Right,
yeah.
So again, 13, 7 years, went from alcohol, marijuana, now you're up to cocaine.
Nail cocaine. Yeah, and at that point, I was just like, my main goal in life was like, how can I get more high?
Yep.
What's the next best thing, like, that'll make me feel better? Like, I just wanted, I was into like just trying different drugs, take me out of myself. I tried cocaine at that point. That's when I started trying the pills, opiates, Xanax.
Yep.
And I tended to like those more than the cocaine. And I did that for a while.
What happened to your like life goals at that point?
Yeah, what was happening in your life at that time?
No, it
was... Did you have jobs? Did you hold jobs? Did it already affect your jobs?
I had jobs, but I never was able to hold a job. In fact, I had some good jobs. Mm-hmm.
So would it be fair to say at that point in time, would it be fair for me to say you're a full-blown addict at that time? That to the point where it was now...
That was most important.
It was central in my life.
And, yeah, and you're going down.
It was central in my life. And the people I started surrounding myself with were into it as well. And so it didn't seem abnormal to me because everyone else was on the same page. But if I stopped and looked... Mm-hmm. My other friends, good friends from high school, were off doing college, were off like bettering themselves, and I had kind of distanced myself from them and withdrew from them. And then I guess when I was about 21, I hit my first rehab. My parents, they were very proactive in that, and they saw what was happening, and I was back living at home then. They said, you know, I couldn't stay there unless I got some help. I wasn't ready to stop. So it didn't really do any good at all.
Because they made the decision. They really kind of like said, come on, you got to get into this.
Yeah.
You didn't make that decision.
No.
And now you're where you're at now, with your sobriety. So what transpired? Like, when did you, bottom?
Because over the years, I tried to get clean several.
There was a point in time where you started to decide you wanted to get clean.
Like, in my probably... when I actually really wanted to, my mid-20s, it was kind of like I wanted to stop. Because I knew it was taking me nowhere, and I wanted a life. But I really didn't want to, still. Like, I still wanted to use more than I wanted to stay sober. But I knew that I should get sober at that point. And I tried. And I really, truly wanted to. I really, truly wanted to want it. And I thought maybe if I just, like they say, go through the motions, maybe eventually I'll want it. But I just, I'd have periods where I was happy with things. But as soon as like anything would go wrong in my sobriety, that was, because I had the reservations, that was my excuse to say, F it. Then I would just go back because things aren't going my way. And, you know, why should I even bother if my life isn't getting better? I put lots of conditions on my sobriety.
And so earlier...
That's very important to take note.
Earlier, you also said that, you know, drugs... If you take drugs off the table...
But drugs were never off the table.
They were never off the table for you.
No. It was almost like... I wouldn't have admitted that to myself. But they really weren't. Because in the back of my mind, it was like, well, I'll stay sober as long as my life gets better. You know, if anything starts to go wrong, or if this happens, or if that happens, then I will use. Or even like the one I used to have was, well, when I get old, I'm going to start smoking pot again, because by then it won't matter. So I always had it.
You always had it an option. How many rehab?
10.
You're at this age, 15 years later, and now you're at sobriety. So
now I am,
so see what I'm saying? So in relationship to all of that, you're still almost like a new babe in recovery, even though it's been this long of sobriety,
I feel like
because of this whole history that, so what helped you this last time into sobriety that you've been able to hold it?
Honestly, I think a lot of bad things happened before that should have been my bottom.
Yeah.
That might, most people would think were worse than my actual bottom this time for me. I got a DUI. And I got off my bipolar medication. And I took like 20 or some odd Klonopin. I just took them and downed them. For no apparent reason, I couldn't even understand what I was doing. I just was out of control. And I mixed that with an opiate, which could be deadly. But I stayed conscious, and I was in a blackout for like 10 hours.
Like 2 days.
Like two, yeah, like I was driving around. In that state, I went to a job interview in that state. I lost a lot of time.
What, that was your bottom then, you're
saying? Well, I'm driving around like that. I sideswiped a PSE&G truck. I went over a fence, front lawn, and almost hit two kids.
I was just saying, you didn't die or you didn't kill somebody.
Absolutely.
And then,
you'd be in jail the rest of your life.
They had an APB out on me, and they finally found me. I had pulled into my driveway. And that's where I got the DUI. So,
Yeah, I remember you told me that.
Getting handcuffed.
Yes.
Getting arrested. Then coming out of it and being told what I did and realizing how close I came to killing myself or someone else. And I was like, you know what? I'm getting close to 40 years old. What am I doing? Like, I just, I'm tired of this life. It's always the same. It's always like from one crisis to another. I'm not getting anywhere. I'm not happy.
Right.
There was no joy in my life.
All right. Well, let's leave that there.
It's really good.
We'll talk about that, but I want to talk about now. What we're going to do is we're going to leave that there for now. We're going to go on to Pete. All right, Pete. So you're up. Why don't you start us off with starting your world of addiction?
Hi, my name is Pete, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Thanks for sharing.
Yep, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, and owning that.
Yeah. Well, there you go. You know, it's funny because for years and years, I was one of those people that never thought I had that bigger problem.
Right.
And I made a little timeline for myself, which I shared for you earlier. And I started drinking, I guess, when I was 13. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of, you know, teenagers, you're just playing around with the booze and pot and, you know, just hanging out with your friends and you think nothing of it. You know, you're doing your thing, you're going to school, and then by the time you hit 18 or even in college, it just takes off more and more. And for me, like a lot of people, I did fine in college. Undergraduate, I went to graduate school. I got a master's degree. I became a reading specialist. I did all sorts of things. I taught school for 21 years. And by all outward appearances, I seemed to have my shit together. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the whole time I was doing all this and playing music too, I was drinking like an animal. And I was living like an animal. And I was you know, spiritually bankrupt. I had no center, and it was, I would guess I was living and working to drink and use. And I took a lot of hostages. That's my main regret, that, you know, my family members.
You hijacked their lives, I guess is what you're saying. Yeah. By
anybody I was in a relationship.
Because the addict causes the family to focus on them so much, you're hijacking their life.
Divorce, I mean, the career, people that depended on me, you know, for everything, you know, careers, you know, teaching career, music career, down the drain. And not so much poor me. A lot of people say, oh, well, drinking and drugs took this from me. I gave all those things to my drinking, alcoholism, and my addiction. I gave it hand over. And it's true what they say. They say from Yale to jail. And I ended up, they say, it's jails, institutions, and death. No, I got out of jail a month ago. I had been in jail prior to that for drinking and driving offenses. And that really messes your life up. It pretty much puts a stop to you. Well, you can't drive anymore. You can't really work anymore.
You were a functioning addict for a long time.
You were able to hold a job
is what I mean by functioning addict. I mean, you were using and you were able to maintain your job. Because, again, what you're sharing is, you know, I had some success in life and I'm using. But eventually, it caught up to you. You know, and I'm thinking about our listeners out there, young kids listening to the show or parents of young kids listening to the show. Because I was the same place you two were, you know, 13, 14, partying, enjoying, having fun. It was a great time in the beginning, you know, and then the hook is set. And some bottom out sooner. I bottomed out very soon because I don't do anything in moderation life. And I was so extreme, I would have been dead very early. So by the grace of God, I you know, came out of it sooner. But, you know, you're sharing your stories, you know, 40 and your age, and we're long term, you know. And so I just want our listeners out there to hear that, yeah, you may function for a while, but I'm telling you, you're not fully functioning.
No, absolutely
there's hell and turmoil around you
and people
during
know.
That.
People
right?
notice that. They see your heavy drinking, your heavy, they know what's going on. I mean, just, you know, you just maintain employment and you maintain that facade even to yourself. You start buying into the fact that, no, this isn't really affecting my life, until it blows up to the point where, you know, there isn't really any coming back any longer. And that's what people who are on the threshold of this disease, we need to know. And then there's a whole mental illness component. I'm bipolar, severely bipolar. And I was untreated, and I have had periods of sobriety between 2000 and 2012, a year, 8 months, 10 months, year and a half, just about 2 years. And I always drank, and I never... And then I would go to use. It was like a big cycle. You know, alcohol, cocaine, / crack, heroin, back to the booze again. And, you know, that's not functioning. It's existing. You know, I kept having my brushes with the law far enough apart where, you know, it didn't really hit me till 2010. That's when everything I had to do, my first 6 months, 180 bid, and then I got another one in 2013 for driving. And then I would continue to drive on the revoke list. And then, you know, it got to the point where I wasn't on any psych meds. I was drinking and using heavily, and I basically did commit suicide.
You know?
I wanted out. I was done. So we went from being 13 and partying with my friends to like eating a bunch of pills, drinking 2 pints of vodka, and shooting every unit of insulin I had.
Right.
Wow. And for those of you who don't know,
that was your suicide attempt.
Yeah, wow. And it worked. I was in a coma for 10 days. And they were telling my parents that I wasn't going to be able to talk or walk, and I was probably going to have to live in an institution the rest of my life.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a miracle. Yeah. And that's where it took me. Yeah. And I never thought it would take me there. And now, you know, I've been out of jail about a month, and I'm putting my life together. And, you know, I haven't picked up or even thought about picking up, maybe once, really at all. The last time I got out of jail, which was in 2010, I got out of jail. I was wasted 6 hours out. Wow. First hours. I was drinking. Then I was back in Camden and using, smoking crack.
Well, I think like you were sharing with me earlier is like, yeah, you realize that your life is degrading to the place of, I call it self-suicide, and you were right there at the doorstep, 10 days in a coma and stuff. So you're like saying, I don't want to come out and go back to that because I know I'm going to be successful eventually one of those times.
Yeah.
So I got to change what I'm doing in life. But so she was saying even after suicide, you did go back.
I went out. I stayed six months in Lakeland.
Yeah.
And then I stayed in Kennedy. And I was a bunch of psych programs that I would still intermittently use and drink. Wow. My poor parents, you know, they saw all this happening. I'm living in their house. And they kept telling me, look, these are the consequences. They're going to get worse and worse and worse. And they did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sadly, I didn't heed any of their warnings. You know, eventually, I even had to leave their house for a little while because they couldn't take it. And I don't blame any of them. It's horrible what you do to the people around you who you love. You always hurt the ones you love the worst.
And you know,
but that's also what ends up helping you relapse again is because you feel so bad.
Yeah.
About what you've done to the people that you love, right?
That and the fact that when I got manic, just I wanted to use more than anything. I can't even put that into words. That feeling,
I know.
That just that urge that you know you got to drink, you got to use, or you're going to explode. You just feel like, and if you don't do it, and nothing could have
stopped. Feels like life and death, like at the moment.
If it happened here right now, I would get up from this table and leave and walk to wherever it was that I could find something to drink, and I would drink.
Driven.
Much to your dismay, my fiance's dismay. Shannon and I are going to get married.
Yeah.
You know.
Congratulations. There you go.
Did you just get engaged?
No.
Yeah, I remember. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, beautiful. If I could interrupt, because I got a thought, and I just want to bring it out to our listeners. When you listen to Shanna, and you listen to Pete here, 13 years old, just building with their addictions for a couple decades or more. Both of them are sharing, you know, the families couldn't get through to them, and we've always said that. The addict, the family's not going to change the addict.
Consequences either.
And even the consequences, like you said, a suicide, and I still came out and used them, whatever.
Jail.
It's not a logical process.
It is not a logical. But I think what I'm wondering, it may help, may not help, but they started at 13, both of them that early. I started back when I was a teenager. I'm wondering, I don't know if there's a value for families and parents to play like a show like this to their 10-year-old, 11-year-old, before they start using, to be able to show them that all three of us started with fun. So this way the 10, 11-year-old hears that it's going to come as a fun. Friends all introduced us to drinking and drugging as a fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you played a show to your 10 or 11-year-old before that occurs, then maybe it'll plant a seed in the back of their head that says when you're offered at 13, you take it, you could end up like Shanna, Pete, or Bill.
And also, I think for children or for parents with younger children, like teaching them a lot of different hobbies and other things that are fun and building their self-esteems and respect for their bodies, coping skills at a young age so that they don't need that. They don't feel bad about themselves.
Yeah. But the mental illness component, I have to throw this in there.
Go ahead.
As a young child, I played the trumpet. I played guitar.
Yep.
I was in the Boy Scouts for a long time. I wrestled. I played baseball, Little League. So it wasn't like I was this weird kid sitting in my room smoking pot all day.
Right.
You know, I was very active, like a normal kid. And nobody knew. My parents didn't know.
But didn't you have low self-esteem? Drinking beer.
Well, no, I didn't. I thought I was okay.
Yeah, he might have. Yeah. But the point is, you thought you were okay. But what I'm getting from that is, again, it comes down to I was on adventure. Baseball adventure and band and trumpet adventure, and I'm on all these adventures. And another adventure came to me, yes. And the adventure was, let's go party and have fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was at first. Again, the younger the child learns that course of using drugs, and this is a good example, it may take 2 decades. It will get you.
So you play the trumpet? It will get you. You play the trumpet?
No, I was a drummer also.
Oh, drummer, okay. Yeah.
What's different this time?
This time I have, I don't know, you know, maybe it's just that it finally got through my thick head, mm-hmm. you know, sitting in yet another jail cell for yet another elongated period of time, mm-hmm. and then even having my release date questionable.
Okay.
And you know, falling in love yeah. with Shanna, I just couldn't wait to be with her. I don't want to be separated from her again. You know,
right. yes.
if I mess
right.
up again, jail is always looming for me now.
Yes. You know,
the way that I act yes. and how I get, I went from being like, you know, like Bill said, that 13-year-old kid having fun
yeah.
with his friends in the yeah. basement, playing in bands, rock bands and everything else. That yeah. That's part of being a musician, but now the reality has hit me, you know, if I get behind the wheel of a car, I'm yes. going to go away for a longer time, 18 mm-hmm. months, 5 years, whatever mm-hmm. it is. Mm-hmm. If I, you know, get caught being under the influence, I'm going to catch a VOP, violation of parole, probation.
You can't
probation.
Predict how you're going to act.
So these are, that's your motivating factor. Yeah, that's like some of your motivation.
But
what I'm also thinking yeah. is that using is not an option anymore.
No.
Yeah.
All right.
It can't be. Mm-hmm.
And if it's
Absolutely
not an option,
not.
then mm-hmm. what is?
That's
so that goes
exactly
back to the second
point.
Thing
yes.
I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, which was I have to have a strategy and plan.
Yes.
Now, you always hear people saying, I'm working a program. Are you in rehab right now?
No.
No, you're not doing
anything.
Oh,
actually, yeah, I go to a behavioral health program 5 days a week.
That's what I want to hear. Yeah. See, so you're working a program.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So he's yeah. doing a behavioral health program.
I go a couple meetings, too.
Good.
So you hear that, you know, we have to have a different strategy in life to be able to work the program,
yeah,
whatever it is.
Because replace it with.
Yeah, well, because like she said, well, what's different this time? Well, I don't know. I worked programs in the past, rehabs, and
didn't
ate
really
it.
Really work them though.
Yeah.
In the past,
you went.
Yeah.
You got to do the steps.
Wasn't
well,
working it.
Well, what I think is, and this is my opinion, I'm sharing it, is that we go to rehab, we come out, and we really don't have a plan.
No.
You
Correct.
See what I'm saying? I go to rehab, and they take care of the addiction at that time, and I don't, you know, maybe some of the sessions help you with some of the thought processes. But it doesn't say, okay, when I come out, what is my strategy from there?
Sponsor,
I come back out and I'm floating them.
I mean, they say, you know, you want to try and hit 90 meetings in 90 days, which mm-hmm. I never heard of. That's like somebody
right.
made that one.
Yeah, I heard that years ago, though. Yeah.
And then you go to some meetings or you go to an IOP or you do whatever they tell you to do. But really, mm-hmm. inevitably, the plan's got to be coming yeah. from you. Like, I know for me, when I was ever had an elongated period of sobriety, mm-hmm. I had a stronger sense of spirituality.
Oh,
I had a real strong
important.
Sense of my higher power, which I choose
very
to call
important.
God.
Right.
And that is important. When I had my most problematic periods, mm-hmm. you know, especially when I was really super manic, I had no spirituality at all.
Spirituality is very
right. In fact, I thought a cool name for this, maybe Sunlight of the Spirit, because that's what
right.
I was.
Very
when
right.
I'm
yeah.
in the Sunlight of the Spirit, yeah. I'm good. When I'm not, something bad.
Yeah. Right. Darkness descends upon
our other
you.
Friends that we
yeah.
had to interview, that's what they said, too.
Yeah.
If their relationship with their higher power
well,
is done.
And we could talk about yeah. that another
we
time.
We
got to wrap this up
okay.
right here. Thank you, Shanna and Pete, for sharing your stories there, because we want to go to the next section and continue digging into this a little bit. So
okay.
thank you.
Okay, Shanna and Pete, we want to ask you and talk to you about what it's like, because obviously you both are recovering addicts.
Yes.
And we want to know the ins and outs and the bumps and ups and downs and when you've met, and just talk about that.
Well, we met in a way that is not suggested in recovery. We met in an outpatient program, and at the time, I did not want to be in a relationship. I knew that I needed to focus on myself. I really did. At that
I was
time,
on my way to jail, so
and
that
he
was
on his
oh,
way to jail.
Yeah.
So you didn't want to get in a relationship. Right.
And I wanted, at that time, I really didn't want to be, I wanted to be sober.
Right.
So we started to talk, we became friends instantly.
Yeah.
And then we started going to meetings together. And then it just kind of developed.
You kidnapped me.
That's cute.
Yeah,
she did.
I did.
So she reached out.
I
right.
kidnapped this one
yeah.
day, so I'm going to kidnap you and take you to Smithville for the day.
That's
go.
Funny.
Because
yeah.
I felt like an instant kinship with Pete.
Mm-hmm.
Now, both of you were in a rehab program at that time.
You didn't have came out immediately. You
so the, not immediately.
So you, oh okay.
No, I was I had 90 days sober.
Oh, I had a while because I had been in Lakeland,
okay.
Psychiatric facility.
Okay.
So I had probably I think what 10 months when I took
right. You had 10 months on leash. You had 90 days.
But I remember we started talking about like I wonder what it would be like to use.
If we had
together.
Used together, we did entertain that.
Oh, oh, so you let that entertain you let that
we started when we entertained it and that might. Interesting because we never used together and I'd be like I want to be sober but then it just grew.
You talked yourself into
you
it.
Relapse in your mind.
Yeah, you talk. Yeah, yeah.
We romanticized the fact that it was
very
like,
important. Guess what? It was not fun when we used together.
Oh, no.
It wasn't.
No,
it was what happened?
We both changed so much.
Your personalities,
and we don't like our personalities clash.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Like we.
So
fight.
when you decided to use together, did you use the same thing or?
No.
You weren't really drinking, were you?
No, I wasn't really drinking. Mm-hmm. We went straight to crack.
Yeah, I was drunk. I was drinking.
Wow.
You were drinking
wow.
and threw some crack on top of you went to crack.
Yeah.
And then it was a bad trip.
So,
but here.
So you romanticized it and it was horrible.
Well,
it was horrible.
And I think this is for the listeners that they have
absolutely.
To understand. Absolutely. Is that even if you begin to entertain the idea, you start talking about it, fantasizing about it, inevitably you're going to work
that.
Yourself right into talk. You're going to talk yourself mm-hmm. into
but
it.
But I think the draw is stronger when it's someone that you're in an intimate relationship with because there's that like, you have a partner in crime,
yeah.
You know,
and your relationship's good, and you still fantasize that the alcohol and drugs is good,
right?
So you think that if you do
and
that
then you
with
think,
it,
oh wow!
But then she stopped.
I have somebody that I can use with.
But then you stopped and you resented the fact that I kept going.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That was bad, really bad, because she had said, "All right, you know what? I've had enough," and I said, "Well, I've had enough. I just want to drink once in a while just till I go to jail.
And, I said,
and then
no.
when I get out of jail, I'll stop." Didn't really fly. It was,
and that's
the way it happened. But
I wasn't happy with that.
And that's when you started to be codependent
with him
and try to stop him from using
yes.
smashing 40s.
Smashing his bottles of beer.
Is that what you
yeah.
did?
Yeah.
I know. I used to pour out his vodka and fill up
right.
part of it with water.
Steal my bags of heroin.
I'd steal his drugs from him and...
Well, and the bottom line is, as we now know...
It doesn't work.
It isn't. We're sick people. So here we're trying to do this to him. He's not ready. So all it did was... frustrated your relationship.
And
made your relationship go
and
negative
and
go south. Made you mad. It didn't help the relationship. Mm-hmm. And he went and used anyway.
And it was hard because we were both on different wavelengths at that time.
Yeah.
So... It was really.
I was really angry because I knew I was going to jail, and I didn't feel that it was justified.
And I was really scared.
It wasn't justified for what I did, and I had this whole thing in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law is the law, so you can't really escape that. But I was hell bent on drinking at it, which didn't change anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It didn't help you.
Yeah,
and that's why. That's why again, the rule of thumb is you don't get in a relationship because it's been hell. Now, you've fought through that hell, and you're both where you're at today with some sobriety in your belt, but the point is what we want...
As a rule of thumb...
You don't want to do it.
You should.
Because,
well,
see,
what would you recommend?
I would recommend
how,
waiting a while,
like
staying friends.
A while?
It depends on the person.
All right.
Like, until you feel like you can stand on your own 2 feet.
That's important, see?
But see, we had a connection, though.
Yeah.
We did.
And I denied it. You were like, well, how come you weren't pursuing it? And I said, because I knew what was going to happen to me, and I don't want to start anything that might not be finished.
See, what I'm just thinking out loud, we're strategizing here, so what I'm thinking out loud is, again, the sickness created the relationship, and if I'm going to be healthy, then I have to be healthy long enough that says, how am I going to handle a crisis?
You can argue that point.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
he made a funny face when you said the sickness created
I don't think sickness created our relationship. Honestly, and this is going to sound corny, I think God brought us together. I think it was kind of like our fate.
I do too.
To end up with each other. I think we help each other way more than we hurt each other.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because I feel, if I can just add to that.
Sure, honey.
Go ahead.
I feel that because I value our relationship so much, I don't want to do anything that will jeopardize
it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I know using... Well, for a fact.
All right, so let's just say that sickness didn't bring it together. You both came together. But we were talking about, then what would have been a different strategy? Because the rule of thumb is you don't. So if you're the exception outside, when could we have taken the relationship to any level?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would like to have said, probably you want to get some distance between you and addiction. You want to make sure that you're of a healthy mind and character. One measurable to me is, how have you handled crisis? Because crisis makes you go back in.
Well, also, we weren't living together. I was living with my parents. She was living with our parents.
And then you were friends.
Then I was in a period of incarceration.
Six months where I was on my own.
So it wasn't like we were, I mean, we were together, but we weren't on top of each other the whole time. Right, so there was breathing room there.
And then I got sober. So, like, once I got sober, like, I really had time, especially while you were in jail, like, to really just focus on myself and my sobriety.
Right.
You know, so I think that's what's really important.
That was a good test.
It is, and I think that's why they say don't get into a relationship right away, because you want to focus on yourself, you want to get yourself healthy to be able to go into
a relationship. Use the relationship as a replacement for the drug, and then if anything goes wrong in that relationship, then they go nuts and they go back to their drug again.
Very good.
Because that's just a replacement.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case.
And it could be a replacement for your recovery.
Yes.
Because we just get into each, you know, we're just here with each other, and we're not really working our programs, and then like you said, a crisis comes. But for you guys, you've had some success.
Yeah, you've had some success.
Ultimately, but initially,
you had to learn.
And you think about it, initially, like, because we didn't wait, that could have killed us. Like, you know.
Yeah, did that crack once? It could have been over.
Yeah.
Well, the people we stood sad, the girl, one of the girls that we actually were, quote unquote, partying with is dead.
It was her and her boyfriend. And the thing is, they got together. They were both addicts, obviously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She was like a newer addict. She started using because she got with him. Yeah. He introduced her to the drug. Mm-hmm. And she was only 31 years old.
Right.
Wow.
She died.
Wow. In their bed.
Yeah.
In their bed.
So,
you know, all of those.
Before we end this section, is like, I just wanted to ask you about the jail situation. What was that like for you, Shannon? Mm. And what was like that for you, Pete?
Well, I knew no matter what, I was going to stand by him.
Okay.
Like, I was committed. It was hard, though. I really missed him. And I was really, like, in the beginning, I was really scared because he didn't stop completely the drinking, you know. Mm-hmm. He wasn't stopped that long before he went to jail. He had stopped before, but not for long. So I was really scared, like, what's going to happen when he comes out?
Right.
Is he going to go back to it? I can't deal with it if he does because I can't deal with him getting in any more trouble. This is so hard being without him. So, and I missed him a lot, and I was worried about him all the time, being in there, what was happening to him. So that's pretty much it. But we handled it by, we wrote a lot of letters. I visited him 3 times a week.
She was great. Mm-hmm. Made a lot of support.
And so really, how about you? How was it for you to be in jail, have her on the outside? You know, what was your trials and your...
Well, like she said, she was committed, but some people probably would have said she should be committed for staying with me.
That's cute.
I mean, she really anchored me. I mean, jail is a horrible place. Yeah. It's no place really for anybody to be. And a lot of bad stuff goes on in there. I was trying to focus on, you know, our time when I got out, when we'd be together. You know, she came to see me 3 days a week, which saved me, really. When I got out, I didn't want to, you know, like, the point I'm out, that's horrible for me to say. Like, well, the last time I was in jail, I got out and I used right away.
Right.
But, you know, this time all I wanted to do was be with her and see my family, my mom and dad, and just be normal. Nice. I just want... That's all I want is to be normal. I want to be normal. That's all I want. Mm-hmm. I used to think normal was boring and, oh, God, I got to get away from this. Mm-hmm. What am I missing? I should be at the bar. I should be here. You know.
I wasn't missing anything.
No. I just want to be normal.
Missing this, being normal, like having a life together.
Yeah, and I think in our addictions, we don't see that vision of what it could be. No. Like, for instance, my wife and I, I've been sober 35 years. My wife and I, we have fun in life.
Yeah.
You know, going out to eat, going out to movie, go play with my friends, go, you want to play, the band, I go to football games, or I go.
You have a lot more fun.
I have a lot more fun.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
I'm not compromised. I'm not compromised this way.
And you're not anesthetized.
Earlier.
Present.
And I'm trying to teach kids that, too. Like, in our church, we take the kids out on a river, boating, we take them hiking, biking, all without drugs. Because we're trying to teach them what you said earlier about, as young kids, can we let our children see that you can have fun without drugs. It doesn't mean they're not going to get into it. Because I'm going to tell you right now, somebody's going to come up and say, let's go have fun. And it comes down to the child has to have a strong enough self-esteem that yes. values their life, mm-hmm. that says, I truly believe if I do go into drugs, it will compromise me, anesthetize me, like you just said.
And wanting to be themselves and not wanting to be out of it.
I think yeah. society, too, yes. sort of dictates to a kid, yes. mm-hmm. when you hit a certain age, you are going to drink or you're going to switch to drugs.
Oh, my goodness, TV, media.
You're going to have sex. There's a lot of pressure on young women to have sex. Yep. There's a whole lot of pressure on these kids. And it was the same. I was there and you were there.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just it was looked upon differently. Instead
you have
of you
different
know
values.
Yeah. It wasn't a big deal for you to be like
very much
smoking
so.
Pot and yeah. drinking beer in the woods. Right. Everybody yeah. did
that's
it.
Right.
Nowadays it's a little bit more frowned upon, but the kids still do it. The names of the drugs have changed,
yeah.
but the outcomes are still
the same.
I think
in a way if you frame it like really today for a kid to be a rebel is to not do those things.
Oh, that's good.
Yes.
That's
you know
good,
what I mean?
Shanna.
To think, and I think that division is even bigger today. You do see some children just
like,
value who they are. They don't want to compromise themselves, and that's a strong decision. Those kids
it
are
is.
Strong, and
they're
like,
strong.
No, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of us would have hesitated
like
in the past.
Ass.
And all
we
right,
just
yeah.
it was, we just thought
yeah.
it was fun.
Yeah. yeah.
And it wasn't fun, and the fun ended 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is. I think it's braver. I think it's more bolder for a teenager to be like, I'm not going to go with the crowd.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to stand apart.
So if you were to try to summarize a couple key points in the relationship part with dual addicts, how would you summarize it? Watch out for this, and also do, like I heard you say, Shanna supported me when I was going through my tough times, so that would be a positive. So anything you'd want to summarize from what you just guys talked about, you being in jail, her being with you in jail? You know.
It's like the Beatles said, love is all you need.
Love is all you need, yeah.
Love is the answer.
That's important, though. I mean, it really is.
I think
love
it is.
I mean, I think a lot of people who are, you know, addicts, they want love. We want to be loved. We want to give love.
Well, and what you said earlier was, I want to be normal.
Yes.
Yeah,
and the problem with addiction is, and I work with many addicts, is I see that they don't have, they'll have their friends in their addiction, but if they try to break their addiction, go into rehab and come out, they're not connected anymore. Because remember, I left all my friends. I had to leave them. I left them all.
And connection is
and
so then,
it is. Because now I didn't have any friends. I wasn't connected to society. I wasn't normal anymore because I don't have people to hang around with that are healthy, think different, better, have fun with better. Mm-hmm. So I think in the beginning it's very, that's
you have to build that. And then, I had decent friends who were regular people, quote unquote. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I had
non-users,
distanced myself from them and hadn't really been a good friend, you know, because of my addiction. Like, I was there and then I wasn't there and I just wasn't reliable. So rebuilding all that, and if you can, because sometimes you can't, because sometimes, like, too much damage has been done.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, or forging new friendships, which is hard as you get older.
It is hard. And through spiritual aspect is one aspect to create new friendships. If you could find a place, whether it's a synagogue, a church, or you know, something that where you could go and try to get involved with people, like for instance, in community, or you could do it through Habitat for Humanity, or you know, helping other people. So you got these other mediums through which to create friendships. Like for instance, 2 weeks from now, we're having like 10 young couples over.
Oh, nice. I've really found a community in my Noronon group also.
That's
working
The people in that group, it's just awesome.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, and these are people who are working the program. We have to stop here. We got, hopefully you're getting something out of all of this. We got to stop and move on to our next segment. Okay, so let's get into our next section. We want to talk a little bit about the mind, mental health, and how we, you know, that affects our addiction and so on. And we want to talk about triggers if we can. What are some of the things that trigger us off into using? So, Pete, Shanna, what are some of your thoughts on mental health aspects and relationship to it? Who wants to start?
For me, I'm bipolar. And one of the biggest thing for me is staying on my medication.
Because
I go through periods where I think I can be off of it. I think that I'm better when I'm not on it because I do like feeling.
That's good, Pete. That's good.
And I don't notice the difference right away.
No, I do.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? So what is the difference?
Yes.
Yeah.
when she's off.
For people outside,
the difference
they
is
see it.
She's unstable. She's like emotional, like mm-hmm. she's like cries very over like nothing, like
right.
A stick stick of gum.
Oh wow! And you don't recognize that.
No, until, I just feel raw. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's not good for addiction because
I'm afraid you're going to use.
Yeah, because I'm not coming from a rational place, and I'm so raw and so emotional that I become impulsive.
Very interesting.
Okay.
So I'm not making good decisions.
No.
You know. So.
And so staying on your medication is important to stay even keel.
Yes.
Because if I go high or low, then
my decision making becomes compromised
because it's so extreme.
Yes,
I'm working from extremes.
Yes,
and you have a tendency to think, well, because I'm in therapy and I do counseling and everything else, that's enough. It's an inside job. Mm-hmm. I can do it without the meds.
Time and time again.
You know, and I've done it myself. I had, you know, every time I go off my meds or when I had gone off my meds in the past, you know, I would drink. I'd get manic, really manic, and I would drink. And once I drank, that was it.
So you have the bipolar also then?
Yeah, extremely.
We got double whammies.
Yeah, I'm bipolar. I'm bipolar 1 with
I'm bipolar
schizoaffective.
One.
Are you 1? Yeah. Yeah. Are we both 1?
Yeah. We're both 1.
Oh, great.
Okay. No, but the point is, you got support in each other because you understand. You should be able to understand each other then.
Yeah,
we do. I think that's why we're good together.
And as long as you're treating these illnesses... Yeah. Now, left untreated, both of our illnesses are relationship destroyers.
Yeah.
You know,
it would self-destruct.
Now, what are yours when he's off his meds?
I haven't seen him off his meds.
A couple times. Mad, but that was when I was waiting to get them from the pharmacy. But she's surprised when I know right away. I'm like, Shanna.
I'm bad.
And then she's like, how did you know? I said, you've been off him for a couple weeks, haven't you?
Wow.
I always know.
But then he reels me back in.
Yeah,
because I'm like, all right.
So that's a good thing about our relationship.
Yeah, it is
maybe if I wasn't around,
that's very good.
She'd unravel all the way.
I would.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's very good.
So then, is staying on your bipolar meds then key?
Absolutely,
very important.
Absolutely.
Not going into the addiction.
It's not a magic bullet, but it makes your impulse control and your compulsivity manageable.
And Pete, were you sharing that when you went from sobriety, you were saying you were off and on with sobriety use.
Yep.
Your triggers were your manic states at that time.
My triggers were anger, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Anger, fear, and I guess uncertainty. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly anger and fear.
Anger, fear, yeah.
Mine were definitely fear.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Depression.
Okay.
Anger,
sadness,
at life situations, fear at financial security or
loneliness,
losing a job, having
a
relationship. Just and those things are very intertwined.
And you ready for this? Here's the neat thing for our listeners to hear and everything is that those issues are addressable.
Yes.
See what I'm saying? So as an addict, we default to self-medicating.
Yes, absolutely.
And what I want to say is the issues that Pete just mentioned about whether it's a job or something sad happened in my life or anger that would cause me to get upset to self-medicate, they are all addressable and can be taken care of and resolved in a healthy manner that I could feel okay without self-medicating. You just got to learn how to do it, or maybe you need to get professional help how to do it, but it can be done.
It
so I just want to bring
done.
That up.
Definitely.
It's a trifecta. You want to have a professional. You need, you know, the meds are one, therapy or a mycotype program is good, meetings help, and then just being honest with your family members.
And yourself.
And let them know that it's real. I mean, I think a misconception... or how bipolar is often misconstrued is that people think it's, you know, you're just acting crazy, stop that, it's your willpower,
right.
And it's
not
it's that.
Not.
If you could just stop, then
it's your brain
of course you would. Nobody would want to be acting that
of
way.
Of course not.
Living in mania.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, that's what always, you know, gets me about people
stop
that
it.
Don't
just
understand.
Stop behaving
just
that way, young man.
Yeah, just stop. Yeah.
Just stop.
Yeah, if I could stop, it would have already happened.
Just pray more.
But
that's
I think,
another thing you hear about.
But I think,
which one is it?
Pray more.
Oh,
people,
pray more.
Again,
yeah.
Pray more.
Christians
oh,
will say
yeah,
just pray more.
Then you'll
yeah,
get
just
better.
Pray about it. And,
and
I believe in prayer.
And
don't get me
prayer
wrong.
Is good.
But it is.
But
you still have to address the issue.
It's like if you have a broken foot, you can pray about it all you want, but you don't want to get a cast.
You should still go to the doctor and get the cast.
So it's the same thing with mental illness. You need that.
People are very, they don't, a lot of times I don't think, unless you're like sitting in Ancora in a straitjacket, like drooling,
they think you're normal.
Like unless you're to that level, like, you know, you're on like, you know, like tons of Thorazine, and you're
it's like, pull like, yourself together.
Come on, what's wrong with you?
Yeah,
get it together, man.
I like what you said about, you know, going to therapy or counseling, or you know, you do your rehab work or you work a program. I think for our listeners out there, you need to be able to get a diagnosis, and that's why you hear people say, you know, go to. Because you know,
and get a few
you
got to get that
get a few, because you have to determine if you're bipolar or not. I knew one young kid who the doctor had said he was bipolar, and I said to him, I said, "How long have you been dealing with depression and this bipolar?" And he said, "Well, about a year or two ago." I said, "What happened a year or two ago?" He said, "Well, I broke up with my girlfriend." I said, "Wow, go get another doctor's opinion."
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, you weren't bipolar for 20 years of your life. You had broke up with a girlfriend and you've been in a funk for 2 years that you can't come out of, and it's bipolar, let's medicate you. So you got to go get appropriate diagnosis, determine if you're really bipolar.
Communication, advocate for yourself, and ask questions.
Ask questions, yes.
You know, do some research.
Do research, yes. I like everything you're saying.
Don't blindly follow. I mean, I fought it. I did not want to be on meds for years. I said, no, I'm not. I rejected it. And yet I kept on relapsing and relapsing and relapsing. My family doctor, who's known me since I've been like 17 years old, said to me over and over, you know, Pete, you are classic bipolar. You're this, you know, she gave me Lexapro, or she would give me other meds that work, and then I would feel okay, and I'd stop.
Or see a psychiatrist. I wanted to drink.
Don't,
like, his family doctor is very good, but typically family doctors don't know much about psychiatry.
Mine does.
She does, but see a psychiatrist, and if any psychiatrist, like, instantly wants to like load you with a bunch of meds, like that's not a good psychiatrist, because you're supposed to start off slowly with not this one,
because you maybe you want to have the minimal medication that wind up helping, but instead
effective.
Of
that's effective. But
well, these are all good thoughts, and I like a lot of stuff that came out, so I hope our listeners caught some of that, because we were talking kind of fast, but a lot of good stuff came out, a lot of good advice.
I think that you guys would say that with addiction, it's very important to pay attention if you have a mental health issue.
Because if you don't, you're just going to keep falling off that tightrope.
Yeah. And if you're the family out there, what Pete was saying and Shannon was saying is, you know, listen to your kids. If they're saying they're depressed or this, go take them to the doctor, get them evaluated to see if they're bipolar or not. Don't brush it off. Don't minimize it. Don't downplay it.
Watch their behavior. Don't just say, oh, it's because they're kids, you know.
Right. You notice changes, like they're sleeping more, they're isolating more, they're not talking to their friends as much, like stuff like that.
Or they have new friends that you've never met.
Right.
Yeah. Oh. And if you're in a manic state, you can't sleep at night.
They can't
like
sleep.
All night on the phone.
You're sleeping hours
at how much social media they're doing. I taught school. I mean, I had 9th and 10th graders. I saw what these kids were doing. Social media, internet, chat rooms, all that stuff. Even just talking on the phone. If they're like constantly disconnecting from you and connecting with social media, that's a problem too. There needs to be a time where you say, hey, you know, let's sit down and talk or have a meal together. You know, that never happens anymore.
Just talking to your kids and having open dialogue where they can tell you how they feel, and not necessarily always giving them advice, but just listening.
Yeah, amen. Amen. I'm with you with that.
Just
listen.
Beautiful.
Any closing thoughts that you guys on this segment here with the triggers or mental health? Good stuff. Anger, fear.
Well, it's never too late.
No.
It's never too late. There's a good thing. You know?
Never too late.
And, that's really good.
You know?
Right now. Start now.
It's never too late.
Yeah. No matter how old you are. Yeah. And just know, try to be really in tune to yourself and knowing, like, be kind to yourself. Like, know when you're getting in over your head. Don't always say yes to people. Like, know your limits.
Your limits.
Well, I think it's interesting you both are bipolar. I mean, that's another interesting aspect dynamic to your relationship.
But I'll tell you what was nice also, what we got out of this, which, again, for people listening, is that you were able to trust his input. Mm-hmm. So when you turn around and said, no, I'm doing okay. And he's like, Shanna, you're not okay. And the point is you respect him and trust him and love him enough that his feedback is important. So I think, again, for families out there and for addicts, both sides need to be able to have honest, healthy support to be able to give you honest, healthy feedback so that you know that you're hearing it, because...
And you're hearing it, actually.
Yeah. The worst thing you want to be is an addict and have all people around you say, yeah, you're okay, you're doing fine.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Or this one. Just stop. Why don't you just stop?
Yeah, just stop.
That kills me.
Ain't it happening.
I hate that too.
Yeah. All right, we're going to have to wrap up this segment already because we're moving on to our last segment. So thank you for sharing that, Shanna and Pete.
You're welcome.
All right, so finish up a little bit with the family, if there's anything about how to position themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, from a recovering addict point of view, you know, what would you like to tell the family members that are listening that would have helped you get in recovery sooner?
Honestly, I think what helps help me get into recovery is obviously hitting a bottom. I think sometimes families want to help too much.
Okay.
And sometimes it's just better to step back. Be there. Let your family know, that the addict know, that you're available, that you love them, that you're there for them. But, you know, lending money, like all that stuff, like cushioning their fall too much can actually hurt.
Thank you. Very good. Pete, any thoughts? Yeah.
I went so hard that I think if my family, my parents hadn't stepped in, not only would I have been in a shelter, I would have been on the street and I would have been doing really bad things, much worse than they'd already been doing. So not they would ever just hand me a fistful of cash. That didn't happen.
No.
Ever. But they never would let me, you know, be out in the street in the snow with nothing to eat. So I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. This is an individual thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want a person who's in your house who's stealing your jewelry right. and selling it for heroin.
Very good.
I was not that person. So for, you know, mm-hmm. my parents, now, had I ever done anything like that,
mm-hmm.
believe me, the locks would have been changed. There would have been, like, you know, steel on the windows, and I wouldn't have been allowed there.
But I
love it.
Were they giving you, it's okay. Were they giving you money, though, when you were going out and buying drugs?
No, absolutely okay. not. See, they gave me a place to live and food. That's
so
it.
I guess
See, I love that.
That's very good.
I
so it goes along with what
there's
you're saying.
Boundaries. Yeah, there's boundaries. They had boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everyone has a but right
without them, I'd
to
be dead.
Set their own
I would
boundaries.
Be dead.
Correct.
So you came up with a very important thing, which is the Narnon approach.
And your parents said that it, for you, too.
They is did.
And the yeah. fact that...
But I think I would have hit bottom sooner had I not had as much help. I would have taken more responsibility for myself.
But would that have been better?
More accountability. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's her reality. Yeah. And yeah. I like the fact, I'd rather have mm-hmm. the fact of the ambiguity.
Because
I don't like the maybe like you're saying, well, I don't like this all or none thinking that everybody, your family should just cut them all off and everything.
That's what I don't like. That's what I hate.
I understand. And I'm hearing that.
Individual.
And what I'm hearing her saying mm-hmm. is, in my case, maybe a family.
They helped me.
Yeah,
so.
they need it. So, again, what we're saying here is the families need to evaluate each situation
what's
in their child
them?
And figure out a solution.
And
one may
child.
Be a harder position with one child mm-hmm. that says no. Mm-hmm. You're getting out because you're using your out.
That might
somebody
work
somebody else
one.
May, and it may not work for some.
That's right. Remember the time the counselor told your parents mm-hmm. to leave you out in the snow?
Yeah, that was a little extreme.
I mean, come on.
I was 20 years old.
You didn't, what you mm-hmm. just said, you don't, I don't think you believed, or you didn't live.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
otherwise you'd have said, oh, no, I'm going to stay right. out in the snow.
So, and what
no,
Pete.
No, what I'm saying, Pete, is I think family members should set boundaries for themselves. They shouldn't let themselves be taking advantage
Very
of.
Very good.
Correct. Because an addict will
know?
Take advantage of
Very
you.
Good.
They're going to lie, saying. Cheat, steal.
I like
They're
it
gonna...
because you both have different views, but it'll right. help our audience come up with a balance.
Yes,
I mean,
thank
you can
you
help
for
to an extent.
That.
Balance yeah. is a good word.
Because the Narnon approach you said in the beginning when you opened up was the fact that your parents or your family always shows that they love you,
yeah.
but not necessarily try to fix you and jump in
right.
and always
That's
tell
what
you
I'm
what
saying.
To do.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I'm saying. And yeah. also, addicts, they become very self-centered. They think like the universe revolves around them. It's all about them.
Yes.
And from a family member's perspective, like they have to have their own lives. It's
Very
not
good.
All about the addict. You know, you can love them and help them as much as you decide you want to, but, you know, you have your own life to live.
What would it be like you from know? An addict's perspective if your family did start to work on their own on
If
issues
they start working on their own issues
uh-huh.
and still loving me and, like, say I was on the streets, like, feeding me or whatever, giving me mm-hmm. a place to live within reason,
mm-hmm.
but they're working on their own stuff now,
mm-hmm.
then that gives me the space to work on my stuff, not feel smothered, and to really take a look at myself apart from them and what they want, and
mm-hmm.
think, what do I want?
And maybe you don't have to
you
feel
know?
Like you have to fix them
I don't,
either
right.
because they're taking care of themselves.
Right. I'm not doing this to please them, or I'm not thinking like, oh, I've got to stop because I'm hurting my family. I'm thinking
mm-hmm.
about why I really want to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
very
it's
much
just
so.
We're trust me, we're doing this
mm-hmm.
for families. Our show is
yeah,
Families Recovery because
so.
We believe the family is very sick. And we think and you know, you want to use cliche terms as enable, but the family in its dysfunction plays a role together. We know from history that if I give an addict $20, he's going to buy drugs. And what we're saying is the family should not be supporting and enabling that addict. So there's a balance here that says, you're saying, I'm wondering if the family could still allow the addict to have a room. They need to be very aware that the addict may play you. I know addicts will do whatever they have to do to rob, steal, cheat, and lie from their parents to get their drugs. Now, what he's saying is you don't have to go as far as extreme by throwing them out on the street.
What I'm saying, too, is...
But you got to set healthy boundaries.
Doesn't the family have a right to have a decent life and not have to take care of the addict? Can't they say, I'm done, I don't feel like doing this anymore?
Yeah.
They
do. Well, yes, they do. That. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, does that always have to be, like, what's best for the addict? Can it be what's best for them? Every group is different.
But they love their children, they love their husbands and wives, but they set the clear boundaries when they're needed, and it does
when they're
help
being
them
exploited.
Recover.
And what I heard Pete say is, in this case, my parents helped me by taking me in the last 3 years to help me get there. And that's fine. They set healthy boundaries for you. I'm sure they didn't say, let me go out and buy some drugs for
you. No, they wouldn't even, would never give me money.
So
ever.
The point is,
they had boundaries.
All right, so the point is they had healthy boundaries, but they let you in the house. Meantime, what I heard you say is, I've watched some kids in school, their parents kick them out and has traumatic and negative impacts on them.
Correct.
Okay, so can't the reality exist that the strategies from Narnan do work, and there's extremes on this side and there's extremes on this side? As we head into our final section, you'll hear Pete playing in the background on his upright bass a jazz number called Bye Bye Blackbird. I want to finish up on the spiritual realm, Pete. You and I were talking earlier off the record and we were talking about our spiritual aspect, and I heard you mention earlier in a show about the spiritual played a big role in where you're at. So tell, what has happened? Like, how did it become? What happened for you?
Well, I mean, I've always been, you know, I've always had a very strong contact with God from when I was little. My family was, you know, not like super religious, but, you know, we always prayed and stuff. But then when I got to AA, you know, I got really heavily into the Big Book.
Yep.
Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a few things in there that really hit home with me, like, you know, our sobriety is contingent on our spirituality. And, you know, higher power is always important.
Yep.
And there's a part in there that talks about being in the sunlight of the Spirit. And for me, the sunlight of the Spirit is, you know, being in God's light. And whenever I've been sober for elongated periods of time, I was, you know, morning prayer, the 24 hours a day above, just praying, meditating. I used to live in Williamstown. I used to live in by a lake. I used to go out in the morning and just sit by the lake and pray, or just, you know, meditate and just watch the water. I'd go to work.
So you had that spiritual connection.
Oh, yeah. I never had a bad day at work. And as long as I did all that, I remained sober. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, I started, you know, hanging out with the wrong type of people. You know, I got into a relationship, which was a bad choice of doing. And then, you know, slowly the prayer waned, the meditation waned. And I ebbed out of that sunlight of the Spirit. And before I knew it, I was drinking. And before I knew it after that, another job loss. Some brushes with the law, back into the drugs, and it was really bad. So, for me, an integral piece is the spirituality piece, and the God piece.
Yeah.
Staying connected.
And finding that time for connection every day.
Well, my thoughts on that, Pete, we need to be gracious to ourselves, because in our spiritual journey, it doesn't mean we're like at some perfection spot. Mm-hmm. We're still human, but it is a key component to stay, you know, centered and balanced. It's one of those key components. You and I were talking earlier about, well, I may think about everything I've done, and you know, whether or not you know, in my addiction I did some behaviors that you mentioned earlier about I think it was a hijacking my family, I think that, or something.
Hostage
my family. You know, and other addicts know out there that they've, you know, stolen from their families or lied. And so we look at our past history and we may be embarrassed about that or ashamed from it. And what I thought about is, I was mentioning to Pete that in the Bible we had an example of Paul. And Paul turned around and said, I am the chief among all sinners. This is how he felt about himself. So now, here's a man of God who wrote the Bible that God impressed and write, and he was looking at himself and says, I see what I've done. He was murdering Christians and persecuting Christians before he come to his spiritual awakening. And he didn't feel good about it. He says, I'm a chief among sinners. But yet God was using him. So I think we have to realize that that part of who I am, it is a coexistence. You know, that we aren't perfect. We do make mistakes, and we have made mistakes. We may still make mistakes, but that does not negate our spiritual connection with God and the value that he sees us as his children. Paul owned his past by saying, I'm a chief among all sinners. I persecuted Christians. And we don't have to be embarrassed about that. And I think I was mentioning, Pete, to you earlier, is that our history, our past, and who we are becomes the testimony of our spiritual growth. So eventually people look back and say, wow, so that's what you did? That's who you were? That, oh, you lost your job? Oh, you were this? You went to jail? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is where God has brought me, you see, in my spiritual walk and journey. So I'm not ashamed of that. That is who I was, and it actually testifies to God's power to restore us to sanity. So that's my closing thoughts on the spiritual aspect. I just want to thank Shanna and Pete for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
You, it's amazing.
It was amazing. You did help a lot. And I think a lot of families are going to get a lot out of this show.
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. For our listeners out there, we'll see you next month. Get off the merry-go-round.
Get off of it.
There you go.
It's much better.
There you go. Bye-bye.